So today what I'm going to talk about is a sort of overview, which some of you are familiar with and some not so familiar with, about a central question in immunology, immunological memory, and really view that with for the cytolytic T cell compartment. And probably Alan and Nigel Burrows and Rob will probably have a do some fairly lengthy calculations. They started before this talk while I do that bit. But towards the end, if I get the time, I'm going to explain some new results which actually just came out the night before I took my flight over here with Roland, where we for the first time measured how fast in vivo these cytolytic T cells, which see virus-infected cells, actually kill these virus-infected cells in vivo from data. So hopefully, and I'll do that on the board because it's all very fresh, and I haven't yet got slides for it. Okay. So as an outline about what I'm talking about is one particular part of the immune system, like Alan yesterday talked about the humoral part of the immune system, the B cells which make antibodies which bind surface shapes and then control the pathogen. There's another arm which Miles talked about, which is cytolytic T cells which don't recognize pathogens which are extracellular, but instead they really recognize intracellular infected cells, and they do so because each cell, when infected, chops up the pathogen into little bits and displays it on the surface of the cell. And sort of one of the interesting ideas in immunology is how these cytolytic T cells or CD8 cells, and immunologists always have more than one word for the same thing and then proceed to use both words half the time, which is quite annoying, and I sort of realize I'm becoming an immunologist because I'm doing that more and more. They look at these CTL, and these CTL are important for immunological memory. So what am I going to do? I'm going to try and make a simple model for how long these responses last and explain how it can be applied to vaccines, something like Miles talked about, and most important, how these models can be brought into risky contact with experimental data. Then how do we test the models, and very briefly touch, but probably try not to stay too long in this difficult topic of CFSE turnover, okay? And turn over more rapidly to another question which has been quite interesting, of how immunological memory actually protects from pathogenesis. What we really want is not to get ill. We don't care too much to a first approximation about being infected. And of course, if I get the time, I'm going to talk about on the board right at the end about some very recent work I've been doing. Okay, all in 1 hour. Okay, a historical introduction to the idea of immunological memory. Back, the first person who sort of noticed it was Thucydides, who noticed that those who'd successfully recovered from a disease were able to nurse the ill without any problem about getting infected. The next wonderful observation was a Danish physician, Panum, who noticed that the Faroe Islands had a measles epidemic in 1781. And because its population size isn't large enough to allow measles to become endemic over there, there'd been no subsequent cases of measles till a ship brought measles there to the island again in 1846. And Panum made the wonderful observation that those people who'd had measles in 1781, none of them got a subsequent case of measles. So he noticed there's long-lasting long-lasting protection from subsequent infection. And then in the 1930s, really, lots of experiments started which showed that you got immunological memory to things like yellow fever. So what do we really want to do? What we'd like to do to understand immunological memory is we'd first like to make a simplification. What we're going to talk is how immunological memory, just in this cytolytic T cell population, the CD8 T cell population, works. So that's the first simplifying assumption for this talk. So what happens in initial infection or immunization? You boost your cells to a certain level. Thereafter, we'd like to know how the population decays, what rules govern the rate of loss of memory, and then we'd like to, of course, know how this memory correlates with protection. And so we'd then be able to ideally get an idea of when we'd lose protection from disease. And that would give us an idea of how long immunological memory lasts. As is typical in biology, historically this argument has been put into a two camps, one of which said immunological memory does not wane, the other one of which says immunological memory waned relatively rapidly, and what was required to keep it up was the continual presence of antigen. In other words, infected cells to stimulate the CTL. And what we'd like to answer is how fast this memory will decay in the absence of continual stimulation with antigen, and that should help give us a resolution between these two opposing camps. So as I said, there were these two camps, and one started by saying they were long-lived memory cells. These cells didn't turn over, they just stayed around. That was rejected relatively rapidly by some beautiful experiments by Jonathan Sprint, who showed that all memory T cells turn over quite rapidly. So then the question became, what was required for the maintenance of these populations of cells that were turning over? One camp said it required continual presence of antigen, either as persistent antigen or as re-exposure, and the other camp said it didn't require antigen to maintain memory. And some very elegant experiments, which essentially transferred cells but no antigen, showed that essentially in mice, over the time course of a grant or an experiment, which is a couple of years, transferred cells, the population was maintained even without antigen. So the question then became, what maintains the population of cells, memory cells, in the absence of antigen? And there were a number of hypotheses, and the two most appealing of these, one was that what happens is if you have an infection with a virus like the measles virus, subsequent infections with other pathogens, which we always encounter, boost in a non-specific way the population of measles-specific cells. And this was viewed as one of the mechanisms by which memory would be maintained, and it was called cross-reactive or bystander stimulation. And at the same time, a very nice thought by Benedita Rocha and Antonio Freitas pointed out that actually this wasn't required, and just homeostasis, maintaining a constant total population of CD8 T cells might be sufficient, and you might not need cross-reactivity.
Question.
Yes.
How do you tell, is it just, you can just look at the cells and see that you have these memory cells?
Yes.
But because they're bigger?
This is the slide where I'm explaining it. So if you look in a mouse at a typical infection, I've plotted the log number of CD8 cells per spleen to two different bits of a given pathogen, which is the lymphocytic chorioamnionitis virus. Okay? And the virus infection lasts about 5 to 7 days. The population of CD8 cells goes up, and the way you measure them is you measure the cells which are specific for this little bit of virus on the MHC, because you have a little marker which can detect just those cells and not others. Okay? And they're called MHC tetramers. So you can measure these populations of cells, they rise, they fall, and then for about as long as you go out and look for their populations, they are maintained relatively stably. Okay? So the way these, do you want to know more about how you measure these, or that's sufficient? Okay. Okay, so we'd like to look at how long the memory would last in the absence of further stimulation. So we define memory just as the number of cells, And what we decided was to ignore this transient expansion and contraction, just see what would happen to the memory population following stimulation, assuming stimulation was relatively brief compared to the longevity of memory, so we could simply model infection as generating a certain number of memory cells. Okay. So this is what the model of the immune system would look like. You have cells with different specificities, X1, X2, X3 to Xn, and that's the repertoire of cells with different specificities. Okay. So N is very large, you've got a huge repertoire, and very few cells for any given specificity. On stimulation, so you get these cells, and in an adult, you can get these by relatively rare input of new cells from the thymus at some rate. Now, the other way you can expand this population is by relatively rare stimulation with specific antigen. So on infection, you would expand from a very small number, and you jump to a number like, say, 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4 memory cells. So very rarely, so in a stochastic way, you'd stimulate cells, and you'd get a population of, say, M cells generated on stimulation with the specific antigen. Now, we incorporated the other terms which would change the population of cells as a term which is proportional to cross-reactive stimulation. So this population X is stimulated at frequency which is the frequency of exposure to any antigen multiplied by a term which is C, which is just a coefficient, which is how much stimulation with other antigens affects a given antigenic specificity to which those other antigens are not specific. The cells could die at a death rate D. And finally, we know that the total population of this entire ensemble of cells is maintained constant. So there's some unknown function of the total population which simply maintains the total population constant. So there's homeostasis.
What is Q?
So Q is the rate of stimulation with pathogens. So different pathogens can come out.
Is that QI?
So QI is a stimulation with just the I pathogen. So So what happens is this is very... Yes.
So you call it capital Q. It's
yes, it should be capital
Q. Sub.
Yeah, or N times small q. It would be the same as N, the total number of specificities, times the Q for an individual specificity, right? Each individual lineage gets stimulated with probability small q. You get a stimulation of any given one at a rate.
All the same.
The same, yes. And for the beginning, we assume that all of them are the same. And what that allowed us to do was, yeah?
Is the QI star term not multiplied by an XI? Is it
well, we. For the beginning, all we said is we want to just allow each stimulation to result in a certain number of memory cells, and we didn't want to look at subsequent stimulation of that lineage. We just wanted to see how that population would subsequently decline in the absence of specific stimulation. So we let all stimulations or all antigenic exposures result in about the same population size of memory cells being generated. Yes?
Try to maintain the total capital X constant. Why should it be proportional to XI?
No, so homeostasis maintains the total population constant, but each individual lineage is acted upon the same way as any other lineage. So each cell is operated on in an antigen-independent way. So so if there are 10 cells against one given specificity, their population will change 10 times as much as a lineage with one cell, right? Or does that make sense?
But you have a separate condition that capital X is constant.
Yes.
That's a subsidiary. Okay. That's not in
okay. So if you look at simply the total population, what regulates it is input from the thymus, stimulation to any antigen, and then a term which consists of cross-reactivity, homeostasis, and death, right? Since the total population size is constant, you can simply set this equal to zero, so you can determine what the term CQ times the cross-reactive stimulation, homeostasis, and death on average are. So now, since we have this term on average, we can substitute it back into our first equation for a given lineage, and then we can get the answer to what we want, which is how the population of an antigen-specific lineage changes in the absence of subsequent exposure, so in the absence of any subsequent term for MQI, right? And we do that, and we find that it changes by two factors. One is input of new cells coming in from the thymus. So new specificities of that. New cells coming in from the thymus, which is relatively small. And the other one that it changes is it changes due to stimulation with other antigens. And this is, specific new cells. So it's by other cells coming in to other specificities from the thymus and stimulation of other cells of other lineages, okay? So you can see that what's going to happen here is actually very simple intuitively. You have a bucket of size capital X, and you're looking at the number of cells of a given specificity, how this population changes in the bucket. Now, since these are the memory cells against a given antigenic lineage, we want to see how this population changes, and what's causing it to change is really, in this very simple model, putting in new cells of other specificities. We have to throw some cells out in order to maintain a fixed number of cells in the bucket. Is that sort of clear? So there are two ways in which we introduce new cells into the bucket: input from the thymus or stimulation with antigens. So both of those will result in a decline in the population, and of course the decline is proportional to how big the bucket is. So if we look at this for biologically reasonable parameter ranges for mice, we can see the rate of decline of memory to a given antigen is proportional to input from the thymus and the expansion due to other pathogens, and inversely proportional to the size of this bucket. And if we plot the half-life of memory, we see that for biologically reasonable parameter ranges would be somewhere for, on the x-axis we've got how many new cells are generated per exposure to pathogen, and this is frequency of exposure to different pathogens. So biologically reasonable parameters might be somewhere from here to here, and pathogen exposures ranging from about one every 100 days to one every 10 days. So we see, at least in experimental systems, we'd expect relatively large, relatively slow rates of decline of memory cells to a given antigen. The problem with this model, so P is the frequency of exposure to pathogens, that's P. It's P. So let me go through this. So what it is the number of cells which come into the bucket due to exposures to other pathogens is essentially the term which it declines by. It's simply the product of number of cells per pathogen multiplied by the frequency of exposure to pathogens, right? So the product of these two divided by the total size of the memory pool. Yep?
So why is the half-life plateau at 1.9?
So it plateaus here because of input from the thymus.
All right,
okay.
So Rasmus, is it confounding only memory cells or total cells?
Here we are just having a very simple model with one compartment where all cells are equal. It's not the case, and in fact, it gives us a a sort of understanding of what's regulating things when homeostasis is there. What happens here is that memory can be maintained for a long time, but what happens is that a lot of the lineages which aren't stimulated go extinct. Why? Because you start off with a relatively equal population in all the lineages, and now you expand a few by a large amount, and the others keep going down, and they very soon go extinct. So the repertoire of cells, if we plot it over time in simulations, very rapidly, unless you have a very large input from the thymus, vanishes. So this model doesn't work very well, because while memory to the first few antigens which the mouse is exposed to would last a long time, most of the repertoire would vanish because these memory cells have taken over the entire population. Yeah?
Is the
mouse
or a human?
Mouse. Yeah, so it would be. But when we've done these simulations with numbers for mice, so here the input is, so it would last, well, you're right, you would get a fairly long-lived mouse immune system, but it wouldn't be long enough for a human. Yes?
What is the function as of
it? It doesn't matter. In fact, one of the important things is over here it drops out. And what's nice about that is we don't know what S of X is. And it turns out to look at what the longevity of memory is, it would be, if it doesn't matter on what that function that maintains homeostasis is, we can still get an answer of how long memory will last without knowing that.
So what I meant was, you have a birth-death process that probably controls your function.
Yes.
You have an extra homeostatic term in your original equation.
Yes.
So there's some underlying process that is going on.
Yes.
And that doesn't matter.
How its functional form doesn't matter. That it's there is extremely important. Okay? So, yeah.
I've got a related question and another question. So let's first do the related question. So your homeostasis function is independent of the cross-reactivity. Or
yes.
Reactor.
Yes.
You could argue that that is strange, because probably
what you could do in that case is simply put this as functions and then subtract it from the net homeostasis function. So you'd get the same result.
That's what I think.
Yes.
Okay.
And the next question?
The next question is, so you say E is a frequency, but is it a frequency per year?
Yes.
So does E
well,
that
let's, no.
Year?
Let me see. Per day, so this is 10 pathogens, one pathogen every 10 days, and this is about one pathogen every 100 days. So biologically, you expect to see new pathogens. So it's somewhere in between that range, right?
Well, for the human, we know that the diversity of the memory population can be 100,000 different specificities. Could that be say that we have 100,000 memories in the repertoire?
No, because each one, so this is a slightly different question, which for humans what happens is you have to look at each pathogen has a huge diversity of responses to it. So it's slightly different, right? Because if you look at the diversity of the repertoire in humans, what you're talking about the experiments which look at T cell receptor diversity, right? So there you're looking for each epitope has maybe 50 or 60 different clones. And each pathogen has multiple epitopes, right? So it's much less, so effectively it's much less than that. Okay?
No.
Yes, so you got about, say you got 100 or... In the tens, if you look at private and public specificities...
That would get you 10 to the fourth.
So the frequency, so how often do we get exposed to a pathogen which causes a large expansion? I thought we get ill relatively rarely. So that's... So those were...
That's why I'm always puzzled by this observation that we have been to the
fifth amendment. Maybe we can do that a little late. It's an interesting observation, but I think we should go at it from the other way. Look at how many different specificities of T cell receptors we get per pathogen. And I think that can be calculated. I'm not sure off the top of my head I know the answer to that. But it would be somewhere between in the order of 10s to 100, and then you've got about 10 epitopes per pathogen. So you've got factors of 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 3, which you have to multiply it by. But I could be wrong. Okay. Yeah.
I have trouble following all the details, but what always worried me is that if an individual gets very old or
yes.
an animal gets very old, it has seen many diseases.
Yes.
How come it's, the immune system is not literally taken over by an animal?
That's the next bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just had
this
is mm-hmm. back to my question. I just wanted to know physically what process is going on in homeostasis other than for something. Could it be transfer specificity?
Not. You don't convert from one specificity to another. No, you can't do that. It's just birth and death. Okay. So what actually happens in the immune system is not that you have just one pop. So each specificity, which is the subscript, can exist in cells of two types, the naive cells, which just come out of the thymus, that's the X's, and every time they get stimulated, they go into a separate pool called a memory cell pool, which is the Y's, okay? And the total population of naive cells and the total population of memory cells appears, to a first approximation, to be regulated independently. So now we have two buckets. Naive cells in one bucket and memory cells in the other bucket. Okay? So as...
Is that like yesterday's age?
No. Those A's and B's. No, nothing to do with those A's and B's at all.
Because the A's and B's were the ones that hadn't divided.
No, A's and B's over there are during the process of a single round of cell division, you go from the A state to the B state to the, and then multiple rounds you have to go round and round between A and B state, so it's not the same.
Could I ask, yeah. What about cell division? I mean, are these just lineages, or how often are they during all of this? What is the difference?
Okay, so let's give you some idea of what's going on in biology. You start with about 50 cells or 100 cells in a mouse, maybe, yes, order of magnitude about 100 cells to a given pathogen, okay? And let's call these just cells specific to a given pathogen. When they expand, they form a population of about 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 cells specific to that pathogen, which remain around as memory cells, okay? So they've undergone an expansion of, say, 10 to the 4 fold.
There's a very fast process.
Exactly. So to go from here to here, you have a huge amount of cell division. These cells, left to themselves, will turn over very, very slowly. They hardly ever divide. These cells, on the average, seem to turn over once every 30 days or so. And these two ensembles, the total population sizes of each are regulated independently. Does that answer the question? Okay. So now we see in this model that on stimulation, essentially just what I've said, cells go from the naive to the expanded bucket, and we've got independent terms for homeostasis. The solution to this makes the problem much easier to actually solve. The rate of loss of cells in the memory bucket, right, is now only determined by putting new cells into the memory bucket, which only happens if you get stimulated by cells, pathogens with other specificities. And of course, the rate of loss, the exponential rate of loss, is inversely proportional to how big that bucket is, right? And now it turns out memory lasts, the half-life of the population is very long for reasonable parameter values, which again are somewhere in this range one would expect. Okay? And of course, what happens is the naive repertoire really doesn't get affected much by this process. Why? Because naive cells are only competing with naive cells. The memory cells can't result in ejection of naive cells. So as a first approximation, this model seems to work. Okay? But it does have some problems, and I'm going to introduce the problems. The first is that stimulation of new lineages may be dependent with the age of the individual, so we've just had it a constant rate over time. And of course, the size of the total population of memory cells changes with age of the individual. So one thing we need to know is how do these two factors change things? And another problem, which I'm not going to solve now, but is perturbing me these days quite a lot, is what happens early on? Right at the beginning, when you form a memory bucket, what are the rules for putting cells into it? Because what would otherwise happen is, if you had a bucket of a given size, the first exposure, first antigen you'd see would fill the whole bucket. This model clearly doesn't work over there, because what we've said for the model to work is the time scale of filling the bucket, and the time scale for is much faster. The time scale for putting new memory cells in is much faster than the rate at which the size of the bucket changes. And this doesn't hold for early during infection. So we have to separately understand the problem of what happens early during infection, and we haven't done that yet.
This happens after birth?
Just during ontogeny and just before and after birth.
The rate of production of cells from the thymus is much higher early on. Those memory cells according to the first model.
Yeah, but not according to the second model. And we know the second model is closer to reality for adults. So the first two are relatively simple to solve, because we know the instantaneous rate of decline in a memory cell population is proportional to input A of other lineages divided by the total size. And you just integrate over the whole duration of infection, and we can get an expression for how the rate of loss of memory depends on size changes in the total pool of memory cells, together with how many cells are inputted to other lineages, other memory lineages, at different times, and how at those times we need to know what the size of the memory bucket is. So the first problems are simple to solve, but the last one is not. Okay.
Is there a lower bound on the memory cells for any particular pathogen that will give you a sufficiently strong secondary?
Yes, and let's see, I might try and get to that later on today, but I'm not sure I'll get to that. But, yes?
To get back on the comment that you have this homeostasis function as a separate function,
yes.
In your terms, if you would, for instance, say that homeostasis works on the death process,
yeah.
And then you stick out your neck, mm-hmm. say homeostasis is a negative mm-hmm. regulatory function, then you would solve your early life problem, because first memory will not fill up the bucket. Homeostasis can never expand the population size. You have to wait for the cross reactive memory bucket.
So you just expand into the bucket, and but the problem with that is the early experiments of Rocha and colleagues, which have started being repeated very nicely by Polly Matzinger's group, is that what happens is if you decrease the size of the bucket, it expands and fills it back up.
But that's also dependent. But the expansion is dependent on whether you have a clonal or a polyclonal population that you start with. So if you stick transgenic T cells in, they expand.
That's for B cells. No one's done that for T cells.
So if you are explicit about the homeostasis, mm-hmm. whether, for instance, the cross-reactive expansion or the homeostatic proliferation is homeostatically regulated, or the death is homeostatically regulated, you at least get two different types
that's
of that,
and it might help at the early time of infection. That's a very nice observation. I hadn't thought of that, but I should think about that more for sure, maybe after this. Thanks, Rob. Okay. So the next step is to bring this model into risky contact with data. So what if we assume that really we've made one critical assumption? All memory cells are equal. So memory cells to different antigenic specificities have to behave the same way. If that's the case, and the total population is homeostatically regulated, we really can tell immunologists we don't need to bother too much in an adult how this homeostasis occurs. We can tell them what regulates the size of the memory pool. And the other thing we know is that the cross-reactive stimulation boosting memory doesn't work. So the people who said quite emphatically by a verbal argument that the measles-specific responses need to be boosted by responses to chickenpox, et cetera, we can tell them that this cross-reactive stimulation doesn't really play a role, and the reason is very simple. In fact, memory is a general phenomena, so you have to help every population. If you boost every population by a certain amount, and you have a homeostatic term which limits the total population, you have to decrease all the populations by the same amount. So that's the sort of intuitive reason. And then, of course, we can make a prediction for how fast memory is lost, and it's really lost with how much you expand to other pathogens, and inversely with how big the size of the memory compartment is. Okay, so are all memory cells equal? And this is actually how we got into the CFSE cell division question, because Rafi Ahmed's group, who we collaborate with and do some absolutely wonderful experiments, had looked at turnover of memory cells. So they used the CFSE dye dilution assay to look at the turnover of memory cells. And using this assay, what we'd like is to test the assumptions of the model. That is turnover dependent on the antigenic specificity, right? Do cells of different lineages have different turnover specificity, turnover rates? And the second is, does it depend on the time since cells have been stimulated or the number of divisions these cells have undergone? Okay, so this is how these experiments are done. You inject a mouse with a virus, the lymphocytic chorio-meningitis virus, and you wait for over a month till you get memory formed. Then you take out the spleen cells from this mouse, which have memory cells, and you label them with the dye. You then transfer them into a congenic mouse, and then watch as a function of time how the specific transgenic cells to this virus, which have one label, lose their CFSE. So if we plot the specific marker for the LCMV specific cells in this mouse on the y-axis, and how much CFSE the different cell populations have, we get a cell division profile, which actually is exactly what Rob said, except the x-axis goes the other way in this case. So cells which haven't divided have a lot of CFSE on each division, they lose half their fluorescence intensity. Okay? So, as Rob said, this is numbers of cells, no division, one division, two, three, four. So we want to ask the question, does the turnover of memory cells depend on their antigenic specificity? The way we did this is we compared the turnover of cells which was specific to the LCMV virus with all memory cells taken as a whole. Okay? The second question we wanted to ask is, does it depend on time since the primary, since they've been generated, or the number of division cells have undergone? We analyzed the turnover of memory cells as a function of time. The first question, does turnover depend on antigenic specificity? So we looked at cells specific to a given epitope, the GP33 epitope of the LCMV virus, and those are these cells. So after 21 days, most of them hadn't undergone any division. Some had undergone one round of division, two, three rounds by the CFSE stain. The total population, however, had also, of cells not specific to GP33, had undergone a very similar profile. So it looks like memory cell turnover really doesn't depend on antigen specificity. Yep.
So but these are cells from the same mouse
that
was immunized.
Yeah.
It didn't have any memory cells until you immunized.
No, it had lots of memory cells to other things. It had a large number.
The actual mouse?
No. Okay, so the next thing is to look at turnover as a function of time, and this is really very briefly, we could get away with a much simpler analysis in this case than Rob had to do. There's only one homogeneous population of memory cells. Initially, when injected, all of them had undergone no divisions. That was, they were reset by the CFSE dye being put in. And then after 21 days, most had undergone zero or one divisions. By 60 days, they'd undergone on average more divisions. If we plot how the mean number of divisions or the variance increases with time, it's approximately linearly over time. If we look at mice from another strain of mice over a larger period of time, again, the mean and the variance increase approximately linearly with time, and approximately at the same rate. And now, in terms of the Smith-Martin model, it actually turns out that we can have a simpler version of the Smith-Martin model, because what's happening during the memory phase is most of the time cells aren't dividing. The time spent in going through division is relatively small compared to the time where they're waiting stochastically to be recruited into division. So it becomes a very simple model, which Rob described last time. Just the ODE approximation essentially works very well in this case for a single homogeneous population. And you can see that you can solve the number of divisions as a function of time if you assume a given birth rate and a death rate. It's not quite so simple estimating the parameters lambda and d unless you really know that division, that death occurs either in the resting cells or during division. And what I'd like to point out over here is making two different assumptions, that cells die when they're in the A phase or cells die when they're in the B phase will give you a twofold error in the estimate you get for lambda. And since Rob went over that very nicely last time, I'm not going to go over that today. So to first approximation, we found that these memory cells fit the bill. Turnover is independent of antigen specificity, and turnover doesn't depend on number of divisions they've undergone or the amount of time. Okay? So now, what we haven't done yet, and we're about to try and think of, about to do, yes.
The evidence of the last two statements,
yes,
turnover doesn't depend on time and number of divisions, really just based on the linear increase of the mean division
index. Exactly.
For the three data points.
Well, a little more for the other mice. For NP118, we've got about five. Well, the four data points, yeah. But it's also a little bit more because the division profile isn't different from the total memory population as a whole, right? Because those cells would have been stimulated for a longer period of time earlier. And yet, so it's really quite strong. But what we'd really like to do, where is it? Yes. Yes.
And you also conclude that the division rate is not changing with the number of divisions. But for that, you don't have direct data. You only see indirect data that the number of divisions is increasing with time. And that changes.
It's consistent with a model. All I'm saying is it's consistent with a model where division is stochastic and independent of number of divisions or time.
Okay.
Does that? Yes. You can actually hope never rule. Okay. So the way we'd like to actually address this now is give infection A very early in the life of the mouse, right? Give infection B very late in the life of the mouse, allow memory cells to form to B. So then you've got memory cells in this mouse to both A and B. CFSA label them and transfer them into another mouse and determine proliferation, the CFSA division of A and B specific cells. Because then what you'll have is, you know, these memory cells were generated a long time ago. You know these are generated very recently. Do they really proliferate in exactly the same way? Yeah. This mouse? Because you transfer cells from one mouse into another. You kill it to get the cells out. You have to label them. So you have to take them out from the spleen to label them with CFSE to put them in here. Okay. And then the other part which we are working on just now is, Ray Welch and his colleagues some time ago did a very nice experiment trying to measure what happened to memory cells to a given antigen when you immunize the mouse with other antigens, right? And unfortunately, what happens is, in these mice, to measure things, it's really destructive sampling. You kill the mouse and look at the number of cells in the spleen. There's a large variation between different individuals. So he simply hadn't done enough replicates to be able to get something which could statistically differentiate between different hypotheses. And one of the reasons was that his first infection was his strongest infection, LCMV. So he immunizes with LCMV and follows the LCMV-specific population. And what you really want to do is immunize with a weak pathogen first and reserve your really strong pathogens to push down the weak pathogen, because your errors are not in measuring the numbers of cells in a given mouse, but in being able to push the population down by putting in enough new cells to other specificities. So I'm looking to find someone who actually believes this is a nicer way to do this experiment, to actually do it and see if it's actually consistent with the results of the models.
Does that mean that memory cells with different pathogens are different?
Yes, they're different specificities. One specific to one pathogen, the other specific to the other pathogen. And we have markers to be able to identify their specificities, so we can tell them later. No, it looks like they're identical so far. But if they're truly identical and there's homeostasis, if you put in cells to a new pathogen, you have to throw away some of them to the earlier pathogen.
If they're identical, why would the order match? Why would
the stronger? Not in terms of rules, but in terms of how much it drops the initial population. So if you put in the second population, say you have two populations, the first one is A is large and B is small, okay? If you add B, if you immunize with B second, what will happen is the A population will change by a very small amount. However, if you immunize with A second and B first, the population of B will change by a much larger amount.
Yeah, I guess here's my question. What is the size of the memory cell population for a given
pathogen? It's about 10 to the 6 cells.
Is that constant?
10 to the 7. No, it's very different for different pathogens. Okay, so that's what we're doing. I'm going to skip this Smith-Martin. And what I'm going to do in the last 15 minutes is actually go to something which is very new.
I mean, you can go over 10 since we're asking questions.
Are you sure? I'd really like input on what we've been doing. I think it's a nice question. So I'm not supposed to let this go too far, is that right? Okay. So we were working on these memory cells, and these memory cells and effector cells can kill virus-infected cells. So what we really wanted to do, and I guess earlier, is to look at how cytolytic T cells kill infected cells and how fast they do so. And much earlier, Alan Perlson and others had done some very nice analysis of how they did so in vitro. And no one had really extended these carefully to be able to get a rate constant for how fast these surveyors, the cytolytic T cells, could kill virus-infected cells in vivo. So what happened then was a number of groups developed a very nice assay to start getting numbers for how fast CTL kill target cells in vivo. Here's how they do it. You can put target cells into a mouse. You don't put virus-infected target cells, you simply put target cells which are labeled with the right peptide so they're recognized by the CTL. So these can't replicate, okay? And then you watch how fast they disappear after you put them into the mouse, and they disappear at a rate which is dependent on how fast they're killed by the CTL in the mouse, okay? So now, if you look at that data, and here if I plot number of cells recovered from the spleen, target cells from the spleen, as a function of time in minutes, what happens is the number first goes up and then goes down. So what's really happening is you can't directly estimate something from this, because what's happening is the cells are migrating into the spleen and being killed over there. Fortunately, what you can do is, together with these target cells, you put another cell population which doesn't have this little bit of epitope on it, which is recognized by the CTL. So those cells are the control cells, and you put them into this mouse, and you can see how fast the control cells go up. The difference between these two is how fast cytolytic T cells kill the target cells, right? Minutes. So Rafi Ahmed and John Wary and Dan Barber were doing these experiments in Rafi's lab, and Roland Regas and I have just started playing around with analyzing them. So I'd really like be very happy to get some input on probable mistakes we are making. So the first thing is to understand how cells migrate, and there are two ways we've gone. Okay, the first is we simply take the data for how cells, control cells which aren't killed by CTL, go into the spleen and just fit them to an arbitrary function, a smooth line, if you say will. The other one is we can just choose a function, and the way we've done it is we say cells which come in are population A, they die at a rate D, and they migrate into the spleen at some rate C. Okay? And so if you solve this, you can find B as a function of T is equal to something like C times A 0 upon D. Am I right? Something like that. Okay? So we use this to be able to get the parameters from the control. Yes?
Control cells are also injected into the mouse?
Yes. Okay. And that's a bit which I can tell you how you do that is using the CFSE label. You can label various populations of cells and simultaneously inject them by labeling the different populations with different amounts of CFSE. Since the cells aren't dividing during the time course of this experiment, the control, if it has low CFSE, and the target could have high CFSE, and you can follow the low and high CFSE populations as a function of time. So the control is actually a very reasonable control. Okay? It's only a matter of a few hours. And you would see a peak alongside it, right? And you don't see any peak. You could, but it's much easier to just do it with different amounts of CFSE. Okay? Yes. So these have an immune response, and they can be memory or day 8 or whatever you like, but they have CTL against the target but not against the control. Oh, there's no death in compartment B. Once they go into the spleen, once they go into the spleen, their population stays relatively stable. Yeah. Okay. So if we assume that all killing happens in the spleen and the lymphoid organs, and what you've got is this very strange phenomena that only about 10% of cells you put into a mouse will survive and move into the lymphoid organs in a period of a day. And thanks for explaining me some of the reasons why this happens, at least potentially, this morning. So it appears it happens partly because they first migrate, because they're put in intravenously, they migrate through the lungs, and a lot of the activated cells appear to stick in the lungs and presumably be phagocytosed very fast or disappear. But what the strange thing is, they completely disappear and they're never found later on. Okay, I don't know exactly why that is, but it's a very, very repeatable phenomena. So we can see how the controls go in, and then what we've done is we now look at how the target cells, when we put them in, and we call T target cells, how their population changes as a function of time. So we put this as a source term for input. The source term is essentially got from here, right? That's how they're going in. That's how the controls go in. Minus the simplest possible killing term. And Rob has got a nice web page where he's trying to have the same nomenclature between different groups for what we describe things. People will really understand what we are saying very easily then, Rob. But we'll have an equation like this. Okay? Yes.
Okay, well, aren't you just going to use the state differential equations for the A and B compartments and put depth of B in? You can't just take the solution as the source.
Oh, sorry. It should be. Okay? That's the rate at which they're going in. Yeah. Yeah.
But then you have depth in your source. Why not simply write C? C is the influx rate of your.
Does it matter?
There's at least depth now in your source. The depth of the control cells is the source of the current cell.
Yes, but remember that what's happening is if you plot the control cells, the depth is zero. The source term is the slope over here. So it's high at the beginning and then levels off to zero. Right? Yeah?
Sorry, this is probably a really dumb question mathematically, but why don't we just look at the ratio of targets to controls? In other words, what
Percent of the decay there? Oh, if you look at the ratio and the decay, and that's what people have plotted, percent killing versus time, you've got something that goes down, but it's two. There are two processes which are affecting it.
Percent killing of targets versus controls. So
there's no killing of controls.
No, that's right. So yeah. We cannot always express target as a percent of control.
Yeah, but say you had relatively fast. So if everything migrated in instantaneously, this would just tell you what the killing rate of the targets
right.
is.
But even in the absence of that,
if it migrates very slowly, what will happen is that ones which migrate early will have a long time to be killed before the ones which subsequently come in, and so you can't take out the killing rate.
I don't know why you're assuming that they killed more in spleen than blood. I assume they can be killed in either place. And if that's equal killing.
No, they can't be equally killed in the spleen and the blood. There's a much slower killing rate in the blood. The take is not, presumably not, so the assumption is that the killing rate in the blood, which is a reasonable thing to do, is much smaller than in the spleen. Essentially, encounter rates are much, much smaller by orders of magnitude in the blood than in the spleen. Yes?
I would think when you said the killing rate, I would think it's the constant, that constant multiplies the So are you saying in the blood, if I have the same concentrations, I get the same killing rate? That's the question.
Encounters are much rarer in.
Right. So if you read as a bimolecular, a bi-cell reaction, then the constant is the same in blood as what you're saying, but it's just that the concentrations are much lower. Is that what you're saying in blood?
Yes. So we neglect the killing in the blood. Although you're right, we could put that back in. That's a nice point. So if we write this down, we can get something which is actually quite easy, because the number of immune cells, so CD8 T cells in the spleen.
And the T that's there is the target.
Yes. That's, is that right? Hold Rob responsible for notation. I think it's a good point. I actually would like to make a small plea for trying to standardize notation, because it's much easier to understand it if equations in other people's papers. Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
So what really troubles me is, because I've looked at data which is in a monkey where we've only had blood and not spleen, and now you see the same phenomenon.
Yes.
In blood. So
no, what you're seeing in the monkey, our approximation, is what happens is this killing is happening, this happens in the spleen, and the spleen redistributes into
right,
the blood.
You've got to have that factor for going back.
But the blood is only 2% of the population, so it's a good marker.
In which case, then you could have ignored it to begin with and just gone with the ratios that you've got in the spleen.
No. Because you've got two phenomena happening here, migration and killing. Am I making sense? Oh, okay.
Experimentally, you also measure the number of receptors.
Yes. Yeah. And they stay constant throughout the experiment, the course of the experiment. It's only a matter of a few hours to get stimulated to proliferate. It would be much longer. So we can do this, and essentially we get some. So this becomes something like C upon D into. No, right, C e to the power, and no D, right, okay, and then we get minus K times T times E, and then we can actually solve this, and we get something like T as a function of T, as and so we can get a, and then we can fit the data to directly to that function. Now for the slight surprise. So now we'd like to get a value of K out. So now to sort of increase the tension slightly, I'd like to see what value of K do we expect to get out of these equations, right? So the value of K we traditionally expect to get out of these equations, we can sort of guess. The way we can guess it is we classically write the models as dt by dt, something like this. This is the proliferation term. This is the killing term. Would that be reasonable, Rob? No, no. What I'm saying, what do we expect K to be? So for a virus infection, this is the classic model for what we have. Okay? So now we have an idea of what K should be by looking at how many effector cells already are required to keep just balance the proliferation of the virus. So we have effector cell hat is simply right. Now K is of the, so R is of the order of magnitude of 5 per day, 3 or 5 per day, is that? Let's say 3, LCMV or other pathogens. From mice. And it's normalized to density, so it shouldn't really matter too much. Okay? And the number of effector cells per spleen, you've got a total of 10 to the 8th cells. And so you might expect that about certainly no more than 10 to the 6th to, at the very most, 10 to the 7 to be over here. Right? At the very, very most. So we get K, we expect it to be of the order of magnitude of 3 times minus 6 or 3. Okay? What?
I said, I think you can make the 3 ones.
Okay, thank you. And what we get is we get it, our estimates of K, which is preliminary is much lower. Okay, it's between 10 to the minus 7 and 10 to the minus 8. So what's happening is it seems to be fairly clear, and this is, we've done this for a number of things, and this is the highest value we've got.
What are you doing?
Cells per day, something like this, right?
Cells per effector per day.
Cells per ml per effector per day. Cells per, so the units are, this is cells per ml, this is per day. So cells per ml per day. Yeah, cells per.
K times E and cell, K times E.
Yes.
But what's the effective density? Because in vitro, K times E is going to be the order of, one over K times E characteristic time killing the cell in vitro in the order of an hour or two.
So
it would depend on the density.
Okay, I haven't looked at that.
You need to look at it in your first. So you said you've measured that.
We've estimated K from it.
Right, so you have to have measured the effective density.
Yes, so the effect, effector density is somewhere around 10 to the 6th cells per spleen, because it's memory cells.
No, is it measured or not taking it from other?
It's measured. It is measured. I don't have that off the top of my head. Okay? So what's happening over here is very clearly our estimates of K, and this is the largest we got from different sets of data. Almost an order of magnitude too low. So CTL, according to this equation, aren't the major source of controlling pathogens. So it could either be target cell limitation, could be non-specific immune responses. We know in both cases that there's data to suggest both can work in different systems to control pathogens. For example, if you have Listeria monocytogenes infections, which is an intracellular bacteria, of immunodeficient mice, the numbers go up and stay plateaued, even though there's no specific immune response. It's a non-specific response and target cell limitation, resource limitation, which is controlling the pathogens. And CTL just bring them down thereafter. Yes?
Over here, it was this a priori estimate, assuming that. This K came from the equation there?
From the data, yeah.
There was a D also in that equation, which was cleverly hidden.
No, the D we measured from the source term.
It's the D of the source.
Yes.
And so that's reliable.
That's reasonably reliable.
And that's what you got. So this is what you got out of here.
Yeah.
And you're saying that
it doesn't match up with this.
10,
yeah.
Especially if you add your factor of 3.
Yes.
But I find this doesn't make sense given your experiment. Why'd you lift up your board and show the?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Your original plot was target cell decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
You see from 100 minutes to 200 minutes that they're going down by a couple of factors, 2 or 4. So the characteristic time, just given your data for the decay, has to be on the order of an hour or so. If you're only going, right? So over 1 to 2 hours, you're getting substantial decay.
Yeah.
That means that the inverse of K times E is the rate of loss by CTL.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be a order a couple of hours. So if your effector cell in your experiment is 10^6.
Okay. So if it, I'm not sure of this number. It could be. So let me think. For an immune mouse, an LCMV immune mouse, you have 10% of your population at day 8. That it could be 10^7.
Right. But I mean,
yeah.
Without doing any fancy analysis, just looking at your data, yeah. You know, the effector cell level during the time of detection.
Okay, I'm not sure I do this very accurately.
Okay.
But in doing that, but when we've done this, at least first pass, assuming we haven't made any mistakes, what we find is we get an order of magnitude lower. So there are these possibilities of other factors being important in killing. There's another possibility which I want to run by people, which is the idea that we've traditionally modeled the growth of virus as just an exponential growth. What's really happening is if you look at virus production from a cell, it's going to go like this. What we are assuming is it has the same average, but like this. Right? So normally in a cell as a function of time, after infection of a cell, virus production actually takes a long time before you get any virus, and then you get a large burst of virus. Okay? However, for models like this, what we've got is you get the most virus right away after infection. Right? So what's happening is these two sorts of ways of modeling it will give could give substantially
different
results. Yes.
Keeping track of cells, whether they're infected or not, not whether they're not the amount of virus in the cell.
Correct. But to get this equation, we assume that cells are making a fixed amount of virus at a concentrate after infection.
No, people get that equation by looking at data. You see that the level of virus is going up exponentially, and they assume that the level of virus is proportional to the level of cells. It comes out of an empirical,
No, it's consistent with you've got a set of data points and you can model it to this and you'll get the answer, it can fit quite well. It doesn't mean the underlying model is correct. And what I'm trying to say is that assuming that cells make virus, so if a cell's making virus here, it makes a constant level of virus over time is the approximation we have. And actually changing it to making virus just at the end is going to make CTL much more effective. Because if you have a constant rate of killing, CTL killing over here will be very effective if virus is made late, but not early. So we aren't sure of which one's likely to be there, but I think what was quite exciting for us is we might have to rethink what's controlling virus responses, and secondarily, maybe even change how we model infected cells a little bit.
Well,
yeah.
We've been doing it. We can talk about that later. We should take a break and have people put a coffee private. Why don't we do that?
Okay.